controversy comes in and the judge is deciding, okay, well, what is legitimate for you to know? And in a sense, being prepared to sort of say, certainly to the press and perhaps to some of their readers, well, you might want to know this, but we're going to say it's none of your business.
If you ask someone whether individual humans have the right to some extent of privacy, you will almost uniformly expect yes as an answer. However, the legal answer is not so straightforward, especially when it comes to the privacy of public figures. In this episode, we will be delving into questions related to the rights to privacy and human rights of public figures. From the University of Cambridge and the Centre of Governance and Human Rights, my name is Nima Jayasinghe, and I am your host for this episode of Declarations. I also have with me in the studio Olivia Chen, who is studying philosophy at Cambridge as a panelist who will help lead the discussion. As our guest today, we have Professor Gavin Phillipson, Professor of Law at Bristol University Law School. He is also a visiting fellow at the Bonavero Institute of Human Rights at Oxford University. He has published widely in top law journals in the UK, Australia, Canada, and the US, and is also co-author of the leading text, Media Freedom, under the Human Rights Act 2006 with Fenwick. His work has been cited in judgments by the High Court, Court of Appeals, former House of Lords and Supreme Court in the UK. He is an expert in English and comparative privacy law, as well as freedom of speech and media freedom in English law. Professor Gavin Phillipson, thank you so much for joining us today. It is an honour to have you with us. So, Professor, I was hoping if you could start us off today with a quick introduction about the current landscape when it comes to the privacy of public figures.
Being a public figure can come into both that kind of stage one, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the first place? And also stage two, if so, should the public interest in disclosure override your right to privacy? And of course, because the press tends to report about people who are famous or well-known to the public, whether that's, you know, as politicians or as celebrities, as major public figures, as opposed to just writing about, you know, Joe Bloggs in the street who no one cares about, then most of the cases do involve public figures of some sort or another. Not all of them, but most of them.
Mm-hmm. And Professor, how are public figures' reasonable expectations of privacy different from ordinary citizens? And do you think this is a justified difference?
I mean, I actually don't think it's a particularly useful analytical tool, because I think it mixes up a number of different kind of arguments that are better taken separately, or a number of different factors that are best taken separately. But it certainly is a factor that courts will look at. Unlike in the United States, where being a public figure kind of tends to mean almost you lose completely your right to privacy, except perhaps in very extreme circumstances. In the UK, it's just one factor that's kind of balanced in with other ones. So it doesn't, being a public figure doesn't mean that you lose your right to privacy automatically. And in some cases, depending on what the information is, your public figure role may not really be relevant to it at all. So it's most important where either you're so well known to the public that an aspect of your private life has perhaps become kind of already well known. For example, if, you know, let's say if you're a celebrity and you've been leading a health campaign on breast cancer or something like that, and you've, in doing so, you've revealed that you yourself have breast cancer or being treated for it. Then once information is out there in the public domain about you, the courts may say, well, you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But you'll note actually in that case, what actually happened was something separate, which was that you yourself publicised this matter. And of course, certain kinds of celebrities, and I think we know the kind of ones that have often come from reality TV, where they've, you know, been in a situation in which they've consented to a large degree of what we'd normally consider, you know, intrusion into their private life, you know, sort of dating shows, Love Island, Love is Blind, those kind of ones where, you know, very intimate aspects of their private life are kind of broadcast to, you know, a global TV audience, then they clearly have some degree of reduced expectation of privacy. But that's really not so much that they're a public figure, it's that they have deliberately chosen, or in a way they've become a public figure, by deliberately putting their private life into the public domain. Mm. So that argument, which is often used, is often run by the press, really, I think, is best analysed as being, well, have you yourself not treated this information as private? Mm. And if you have decided yourself to deliberately publicise it, then it seems reasonable to say, well, then you can't really complain if other people discuss it or report on it. Given that you yourself have decided to put this in the public domain and not treat it anymore as being part of your private life in which no one else has any concern.
Mm-hmm. Professor, you bring up a very important point about the right to consent of publicly presenting information. But more of a basic question, sir, would be, what actually constitutes a public figure in the UK? And what is the definition?
There isn't really a kind of generally agreed definition. I mean, definitions tend to be kind of circular. So they tend to say things like, well, someone who plays a role in public life, which then just takes you, okay, so what's public life? So people actually tend to give examples. So obviously major politicians, major public servants like chief constables or, you know, the head of the Bank of England, people like that who have, you know, who actually wield real power in the country are the most obvious and probably the most important type of public figure. And then you have people who are kind of famous for different other reasons. So they might be actors, they might be sports people, they might be kind of, you know, reality TV show celebrities. A new kind of public figure, I suppose, is kind of so-called influencers on social media, which I don't think their kind of position has been really tested by the courts yet. So, I mean, there isn't really an agreed definition. Some people would like a kind of narrower definition that says, well, really, it should be people who actually have power in the country over other people's lives. And that may require that, you know, we know more about them than an ordinary private citizen. But there isn't really a kind of agreed definition. There's, you know, playing a major role in public life is about as close as people get. But that obviously then begs the question of what is public life. But it certainly includes, which is partly why I think it's actually not a very useful category, but it certainly includes both politicians and candidates for public office on the one hand, and, you know, it could include a pop star or a, you know, a Big Brother contestant, you know, someone who's just got a lot of coverage in the press can become a public figure in that way. So really, I think all it means is, yeah, someone who is known to the public or a section of the public for some reason, which tells you it's not a very precise or necessarily very helpful definition, but it's certainly used by the courts, not only in this country, by European courts as well, and by US courts, and most countries in the world use it in relation to privacy claims and also defamation claims.
Thank you for sharing this distinction and your thoughts on the idea. So, as you have mentioned previously, and as many people know, the idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy is central to determining whether a piece of information is private in the law or not. Generally, in the field, there would be two sorts of ways to judge this reasonable expectation of privacy. One is the more objective approach, which basically assesses whether this person should have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and the courts and the judges sort of decide for that person. On the contrary, we have a more subjective approach where the court tries to step into the head of that person to see whether it was realistic that they would have thought of that matter as private. So in your opinion, do you think recent case laws and legislation are leaning more towards the objective and subjective approach? And do you personally think one makes more sense than the other?
What we now have, I mean, this is a good question. What we now have is essentially a kind of mixed approach, which I think has replaced what in earlier cases was a kind of overly objective approach that didn't really take account of the personal characteristics of the claimant. I mean, to give you an example, you know, some people might you might think whether you're gay or not, or whether you have a boyfriend or not, or girlfriend. For some people, they might be quite open about that. They might be, you know, it might be, you know, they might make it obvious to anyone they meet what their sexuality is. For other people, they may be very private about it. An example sometimes given is someone from a very strict religious background, where, you know, if their parents knew that they were gay, it might result in a major rupture in the family. So for them, they may have a particular reason why anything to do with their sexuality, including, you know, their dating and so on, is particularly sensitive and private for them. But what the law does is, because the kind of rule of law generally requires that the law's application should be reasonably predictable, the courts will recognise that you may have particular reasons to be sensitive about something that perhaps to someone else would not be so sensitive, but that it would have to be reasonably foreseeable to, in most cases, the press, but I mean, actually nowadays it could be, you know, other social media users or whatever, but it has to be reasonably foreseeable to other people that you would have that sensitivity. So if you happen to have a rather kind of capricious and unusual kind of obsession about privacy in relation to something that most people would think was kind of quite mundane, then the courts might say, well, that's not a reasonable expectation of privacy simply because other people couldn't reasonably have guessed that you would feel that way. And people shouldn't be subject to that kind of unpredictable and rather arbitrary, you know, imposition of liability for invading someone's privacy if they couldn't reasonably have foreseen that they would feel sensitive about it. So, and this kind of actually matches what you see about, I mean, there's a huge theoretical work on privacy. What you see in it tends to be these kind of mixed objective-subjective, so approach to defining what is private. So the generally kind of the starting point is, well, what's private is what most people consider to be private, because, you know, that sounds a bit vague, but that's really the only way of doing it. And then people usually bring in kind of lists. So there's obvious areas like health, sexuality, family life, things like that, private personal finances. And then this other element, which is something that you happen to feel particularly strongly about, which may be because of your background, for example, your culture, or some other factor that makes a particular piece of information about you particularly private and sensitive to you. So there tends to be a kind of mixture, and both those factors are taken into account. But as I say, with the proviso that something that was unpredictable or unforeseeable to other people wouldn't generally be considered as generating a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Do you have any examples of specific cases that you would like to share that, for example, exemplify what would be a subjective approach taken by a judge in the area that really catered to the idiosyncrasies of the specific people involved?
Yeah, well, a good example comes from the case of Naomi Campbell and Mirror Group newspapers, which was quite a while ago now, but it's probably still the breakthrough case in the area and the most, perhaps still the most important, as well as the one of the best known cases. So that involved the supermodel Naomi Campbell, and the Daily Mirror published a scoop in which they said that they revealed that, contrary to her public denial, she'd always publicly denied that she used drugs or was a drug addict, that in fact she was a drug addict and was being treated for drug addiction at Narcotics Anonymous. And they'd got the information partly through someone had leaked the information from inside Narcotics Anonymous, either a fellow patient or one of the people who was treating them. And as a result, they were able to photograph her outside Narcotics Anonymous, sharing a group hug with other patients, although their faces were blacked out. So she brought a case against them for... It was sort of the law was evolving then from breach of confidence to misuse of private information. And that was the case that really kind of took the step of moving from one to the other. So she brought a case in kind of privacy / breach of confidence. And at the Court of Appeal level, this was an interesting example of kind of using a very kind of dryly objective test. So the Court of Appeal said, and at that point, one of the tests the court used was Wood, which is taken from US law. Would the revelation be highly offensive? Now, that test is meant to be used to say, would it be highly offensive to the person who the story was about? So in that case, would it be highly offensive to Naomi Campbell to have this information revealed? But the Court of Appeal kind of, in a sense, misapplied it and said, would the ordinary reader reading the article, find it highly offensive to find out this information. And they said, well, basically, no. Which then when it went to the then House of Lords, the then top court, they said, no, the mind to be examined is not the mind of the reader. It's the mind of the person about whom the revelations are being made. And they said there was good reason to think that she would find it highly offensive, although they then said really that the issue is not whether it's offensive, but whether it unreasonably intrudes into her private life. So that was a definite move to saying, to looking at the person about whom the revelation was being made and not some hypothetical, reasonable reader. In law tends to use kind of a hypothetical reasonable man or reasonable person at times, but they said firmly in that case, you have to look at what someone who was being treated for drug addiction, in other words, you kind of clothe the reasonable person with the characteristics of the claimant and say, would they find it, as the House of Lords said, the test should really be a violation of their reasonable expectation of privacy. And they said the answer to that was clearly yes. Although the case then also did raise interesting questions about her being a very famous public figure, which led to a kind of compromise between the two. So they said, and actually she conceded this, that because she'd gone on the record voluntarily and had chosen to say, I'm not, you know, unlike some other models, I don't use drugs. There's a lot of drugs in that world, but I've always stayed clear of them and I've never used them. And had issued very public statements about that and to an extent kind of traded on that. The court said that the public had a right to sort of, well, the press had a right to kind of put the record straight and reveal actually that she had lied about that. But they said it wasn't necessary to do that, to then go on and give details of the treatment and the photograph of her outside the clinic, because they said that invaded further than was necessary into her privacy just to give the public the story. So that was an interesting example of her being a public figure, that generating a particular public interest in the story, and how that was then balanced against her reasonable expectation of privacy in what they said was the kind of details, the therapeutic treatment and the photograph, which they said were not necessary to convey to the public and intruded further into her private life than was necessary to tell the story.
The Campbell case was definitely one of the most famous in the field that a lot of people would mention when they think about privacy. As you have just mentioned, there was a different formula applied, which was the highly offensive formula. And this is often applied in conjunction with the reasonable expectation. So do you think the highly offensive formula is somewhat part of what would be contained in our idea of reasonable expectation of privacy? So for example, if it is highly offensive, then it would be reasonable for the person to expect it to be private. Or do you think it's more like a separate later criterion to put onto the case? And does the highly offensive formula only apply to public figures or just to anybody?
Well, actually, one thing the Campbell case did was really say the highly offensive, the high offensiveness test is not really a very good one to use. And they suggested really kind of replacing it with the test of reasonable expectation of privacy. And as you say, you can use it as a sort of rough and ready way of trying to work out whether something is private by saying, oh, well, would someone find it highly offensive to have this revealed? But they just said, well, really, how offensive it is goes to the seriousness of the intrusion, which they said is more relevant at stage two when you're balancing it with any public interest or press freedom arguments. So they said it's simpler and clearer just to ask, was there a reasonable expectation of privacy in all the circumstances? So the high offensiveness test was really sidelined after the Campbell case and doesn't really appear in the case law since. It continues to be used in the United States in privacy cases there, although in the United States, privacy cases are hardly ever won unless they're extremely intrusive. An example being sex tapes, where a sexual encounter with someone is covertly recorded and then sort of released, publicized by a news outlet, which happened with the case of a wrestler called Hulk Hogan. And that was a very, very rare victory for privacy in the US, because in general, the kind of right to free speech under the First Amendment will tend to prevail over nearly all privacy and many defamation cases for public figures.
Regarding public figures, once their privacy is established, so we know that the matter published is a matter that is private, normally for ordinary citizens, that would be the end of the matter. But if there are public figures, there seems to be a claim that people have the right to know certain aspects of their private lives due to the argument that it is in the public interest to know. And how do you think this public interest is defined? And do you think that there are current contentions that are in the debate surrounding this definition?
The question of the public interest, which is also a test used in other areas of law, like in defamation as well, for example, where there can be a public interest defense to a libel case, is quite often a somewhat slippery and controversial question. So, I mean, the arguments for having a very kind of expansive public interest test, particularly in relation to politicians or anyone who's running for elected office, come particularly from kind of American authors writing in the First Amendment tradition. So, for example, that a newspaper wanted to publicize some highly revealing, highly intimate revelation about a candidate or politician's sex life. Now, a UK judge might be prepared to say, essentially, that's no business of the public, even if they have their own moral views about it, and they might be shocked because they've done something, you know, that would be seen as sexually irregular, and some people might think is sexually immoral, although not illegal. I'm not talking about, you know, anything that might contravene the criminal law, like harassment or sexual violence, but just, you know, a perfectly consensual sexual practice, but some people might disapprove of it. In the UK courts and European courts are prepared to be more, in a sense, to sort of tell the public what they ought to be interested in. Because the public interest is not just public curiosity. As the judges always say, the public interest is not just what interests the public. So it has to be something that they have a legitimate interest in. And the controversy comes in the judges deciding, okay, well, what is legitimate for you to know? And in a sense, being prepared to sort of say, certainly to the press and perhaps to some of their readers, well, you might want to know this, but we're going to say it's none of your business. In the US, that's seen as kind of much too paternalistic. And the idea is that voters are entitled to kind of take anything into account in assessing candidates, however kind of blinkered or prejudiced or narrow-minded it might be. And therefore, it's not for the courts to help keep secrets from the public that they might want to use in assessing a politician or a candidate for political office. So there's immediately a kind of big debate there about how far courts should sort of draw lines and tell the public, well, you know, you might want to know this, but frankly, it's none of your business and you shouldn't take it into account in deciding how you cast your vote, for example. Whereas US courts will tend to say the government can't tell citizens what factors they should and shouldn't take into account. And therefore, almost anything about a candidate's private life could be seen as being in the public interest. Because someone might regard it as relevant to how they assess them as a candidate for office or how they assess them as a politician in office. So yes, it does remain enduringly controversial, but certainly in the UK, which is influenced by case law from the European Court of Human Rights, the courts feel that they have to decide for themselves, guided by the case law, as to what kind of matters the public has a legitimate interest in knowing. But that's sort of probably a better way of thinking about it, because public interest could just sound quite close to things the public might be interested in. And the public always is, you know, there's sections of the public that are always curious to hear about people's sex lives or things that they may have got up to that are just kind of scandalous or, you know, in a gossipy kind of way. And the courts have to somehow try and draw a line between just prurient interest or kind of curiosity and things that the public really have a legitimate interest in knowing. But the application of that test in particular cases is often controversial.
Thank you. As you have mentioned mainly in your discussion that it's usually when it comes to political figures that we are concerned with their private lives as part of what the public has a right to know about when forming their decisions. However, we have other categories of public figures who are unrelated to politics, such as, you know, singers, actors, or sports stars. And often the argument tends to be similarly made that the public has some sort of interest in knowing about their private lives. Professor, how do you think this sort of public interest is justified, because we presume, of course, we don't have to vote for any of those other public figures?
It's in a sense, it's easier to sort of have the arguments about politicians because it all revolves around kind of essentially whether it kind of assesses their, affects their kind of fitness for office or the public's perception of their fitness for office. And to a lesser extent, I think that applies even to people who are not elected, but who are important public servants of the kind I mentioned, like chief constables of police and so on. I think the trickiest cases and the most controversial ones in a way are precisely there, where it concerns not people with actually any formal power at all, but just celebrities. And there, what the argument the press likes to run with those, and this has come up in quite a few cases, and you know, they're kind of classic kind of footballers having sex with lap dancers, you know, is your kind of classic, you know, tabloid sleaze story. And quite a few of those cases went to court. And essentially what the press likes to do is run the kind of role model argument. So they say that these people who are very well known to the public have influence over the way other people behave. Perhaps particularly kind of, well, in the case of footballers, for example, perhaps particularly young men. And therefore, in a way that isn't always very clearly reasoned, I don't think, but therefore it's important that people should know the truth about them. If they hold themselves out as being, you know, a good family man, for example, happily married and, you know, a good role model as a good dad and a good husband, then the public has a right to know if actually they're, you know, having affairs with lap dancers and so on the side. And the European Court of Human Rights adopted a kind of similar line of argument, which I and others have been somewhat critical of, about someone who played a well-known actor who played a detective in a very popular TV show in Germany. The difficulty here, I think, is first of all, the courts just tend to sort of don't ever cite any evidence about role models and influence. So it's just kind of asserted as sort of common sense. But actually, I think there's big question marks over whether really people do look up to footballers and expect footballers to kind of, you know, show them how to lead a moral life, and would therefore be heavily influenced if they find out that the footballer is not as moral as they make themselves out to be. And then there's the question, like, well, even if they did, What's the actual public benefit? So in other words, let's say that you are a young man and you're quite influenced by a particular footballer who you kind of look up to. I mean, someone like Marcus Rashford, for example, you know, in the last few years has become quite an important kind of public role model and seems to have actually had some public policy influence in relation to free school meals and so on, where he managed to force Boris Johnson into a U-turn on free school meals. But I suppose the question is kind of, if what the press wants to do is through a kind of story about their private life to essentially destroy that image or damage that image and show that actually they're up to no good because they've been secretly having an affair or something like that, it's not entirely clear what the benefit to the public is, because you would think logically, if you're a young man and been looking up to this football and thinking, okay, that's how I live my life, if you find out actually they've been doing drugs or sleeping with lap dancers, doesn't that mean that you'd be more likely to do drugs yourself or sleep with lap dancers yourself, you might say, if you're really influenced by them? So it's not always clear what exactly is the claimed public benefit. But in general, the press just sort of relies on the idea that it's in the public interest to have a mistaken impression about someone corrected, which I'm not sure is really, or is very often actually the case. And I'm not sure it's very kind of carefully reasoned through on what basis it actually benefits the public. But that's the standard argument that is kind of run. And the press have won quite a few cases about famous or not so famous footballers on that basis.
In the role model argument, it seems that if someone, by the nature of their occupation, just happens to become a public figure, despite the fact that they did not actively seek publicity, sometimes, you know, if you're famous in a field, you can't help but become public. And does this imply that they sort of just automatically have a moral or legal duty to be a role model despite the fact that they didn't ask for it? Is this what the law is sort of implying?
I think people recognize that that's kind of is unrealistic, that if you just become very good at something, whether it's acting or being a pop singer or being a footballer or whatever, then just by the fact of having become famous, I don't think courts now think that there should be any implication that merely just through that therefore you're a role model and have to sort of behave better than other people. I think the cases that the press tend to win is where they're able to show that someone has held themselves out as being a role model to a certain extent, talking about being a good family man, or as in the case of Naomi Campbell, talking publicly about the fact that she didn't use drugs. And that if the story shows that someone has deliberately kind of set out to deceive the public about themselves, then that's the kind of case in which the courts think that there is a public interest argument. But I think, no, in terms of what you were saying, if you just sort of happen to become famous, but you don't go around preaching or saying that some people should live their lives, you just do what you do, you know, whether that's singing or sport or acting. I don't think the courts then think that kind of somehow you should be treated as a role model just because you've become well known. I mean, I think there was some talk about that in the earlier cases, but that came in for a lot of criticism. And you tend to see more now the argument has to be run that they've in some way set out to mislead the public or create a false impression that they've benefited from, and that you know, kind of the record should be put straight.
Thank you so much, Professor. Just to change tracks a little bit, I have a question regarding methods. More specifically, to what extent does the method of attaining a piece of information influence whether it should be publicly displayed? And would the method bear any influence on the nature of the information, for example, if it should be classified as private or not?
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's one of the kind of factors that the courts will tend to look at. And if you think about it, it makes sense. So, I mean, a notorious kind of difficult issue is the question of kind of privacy in public. So, you know, it's long been accepted that people kind of, you know, behind closed doors and behind closed kind of curtains, you know, have a right to privacy. And obviously, we have locked doors for changing rooms and for toilets and things like that. So we know that people physically seek privacy for certain kinds of activities and also just to kind of close the door and shut the world out. So the more controversial question has been, how much privacy do you have in public or kind of semi-public spaces? And the reason that's relevant, if you think about in terms of getting the information, well, if you're wanting to get information about what is going on in someone's home and you use kind of, you know, a hidden camera or something like that, or in one very famous early case, reporters kind of tricked their way into a hospital room to interview a celebrity who was recovering from a serious accident and didn't really know what was going on, and therefore wasn't able to give consent, and they published an article about that. That was actually a case where there still wasn't a right to privacy in English law. It was often, as K.M. Robertson is the kind of case that showed why there was a problem and we need a right to privacy. So if, in other words, if someone has tried to keep, if someone has, through a mixture of kind of social norms or sometimes, you know, locked doors or passwords for their email, things like that, has tried to keep information to themselves, and someone has to in some way use either some kind of intrusive method, such as hidden microphones or hidden cameras, or sometimes bribe someone to give them information, like paying someone's friend or paying a doctor, for example, to leak medical evidence to them, patient's notes, things like that, then the way they get the information shows that they've had to intrude. In other words, the very fact that they've had to use these surreptitious means to get hold of the information shows that the person was trying to keep that information to themselves. So sometimes that's where breach of confidence remains still important, because we tend to kind of, relationships that involve an exchange of private information, like between doctor and patient, have duties of confidentiality around them. So if someone induces someone to breach their confidence by leaking that kind of information, as happened with the Campbell case, where someone from Narcotics Anonymous leaked the information about her treatment to the press, then that breach of confidence is relevant in assessing their case, in assessing their reasonable expectation of privacy, because it in itself shows that they were, and people around them were, treating the information as private, and therefore the press had to do something to get hold of it that involves some intrusion. Whereas if it's just your appearance, you know, if you're a celebrity and you're just walking down the street and you're just snapped kind of, you know, walking down the street to buy a pint of milk, as one of the cases mentioned, then it's harder to say. I mean, the press obviously hasn't had to do anything other than literally just take a picture of you and there you are kind of walking down the street. So in English law, simply a kind of you on the street in a fully public environment, if a picture of you is taken that you don't want to be taken, that isn't seen as giving you any cause of action in privacy, partly because they're only, as they say, recording what anyone present on the scene would be able to see. It gets more, the US takes this to extreme examples. So there can be cases where obviously something intimate can happen in a public place. So there's been American cases involving where there's been a road accident And you get these kind of ride-along shows where TV cameras ride along with the emergency services. So they would be kind of filming a woman, for example, being dragged out of her car, severely injured and kind of babbling, not really knowing what was going on. And that was all kind of broadcast happily live. And the American court said, public place, therefore no right to privacy. In the European and English approach certainly would say private things can happen in public places. I mean, you might have an intimate conversation that you know, you had with a close friend and you were sitting in a cafe outside, but you obviously lowered your voices. If a hidden microphone, for example, was used to pick that up, then clearly they'd intruded into a moment of privacy you were having in a public place. So more sophisticated analysis recognise that actually privacy is on a continuum. And even when you're in a public place, you might do things or say things that are clearly not intended for everyone there to hear. And that if someone breaches through those barriers to kind of get that information, the fact that they've done that, the means that they've used to get that information from you unwillingly, is, as you said, a factor in the reasonable expectation of privacy.
Thank you so much, Professor. This has been incredibly insightful. Before we wrap up today, Professor, is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think just the big controversy recently, and I mean, people who follow kind of the status of human rights in this country will be aware of the kind of the government's plans for a British Bill of Rights bill that seems to have rather bizarrely may have got now mixed up with the fate of Dominic Raab, because it seems to be very much his baby. And if he is forced out by these bullying allegations, then the British Bill of Rights may fall. If he stays, then he will try and bring it back at some point. But one of the reasons that tries to essentially alter quite fundamentally the balance between free speech and privacy, and says, you know, what the government says, oh, it's gone too far in the favour of in favour of privacy, and we need much more robust freedom of speech, and they want us to be more like America in that way. So one of the things that they use is, yeah, one of their arguments for this clause in the bill is privacy cases and what they call judge-made privacy law, and this idea of kind of allowing the rich and famous to kind of, you know, hide their misdeeds from the public using wealthy lawyers. And a line of case law that's sometimes mentioned in that regard is that which regards the privacy rights of criminal suspects. And the most recent big Supreme Court case, which was called Bloomberg and ZXE, was about reporting on the fact of someone being under investigation by a UK law enforcement body. Other cases, there was a case involving Cliff Richard, where the BBC did live coverage of his house being searched in relation to suspicions of child sex offences or child pornography, which turned out to be completely false. And another one involved someone who was arrested after the Manchester bombing, and enormous publicity was given to them, which was horrendously damaging to their life as they were released and found to have been completely innocent. So that's the kind of most recent controversy, which is whether people who've been, whether the fact of arrest, the fact of being under investigation by the state, should be prima facie a private matter, which the courts will say as a starting point, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. But again, that may be overridden because there may be a particular public interest in knowing that someone's been arrested or knowing that someone is under investigation by the state. But that's the latest kind of development. That's the latest sort of big case. And that has been quite controversial, although it actually does accord with police practice, which is not to release names of people who've arrested. And opinion polls actually show the public is behind the idea that you should have a right that should be kind of a confidential private matter up until the point at which you're charged. And then if you're charged, then it becomes a public matter and open justice then prevails and the rest of the process occurs in public and can be reported on.
Thank you so much, Professor. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot from this conversation. I know I sure have. Thank you so much for being here. We hope everyone has enjoyed today's podcast. For those listening, if you have any questions or comments, please find us on Twitter via @declarationspod or like us on Facebook. You can also send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. You can also check out our website, where each podcast has a companion piece with more information about each episode and links to additional resources. Thank you so much for listening and your support. And to Professor Gavin Phillipson, thank you so much for being here. Please do tune in next time for more declarations. Thank you.